This episode of Basel Podcast is sponsored by Kisco Labs. In office work, we realized how important it is to have an ergonomic chair. A crappy chair can destroy your productivity and, in the long run, even your health. We've understood this to be true with chairs, yet not with the IT systems that we use. Many of our IT systems are still crappy, and their negative impact on our work is huge. Kisco Labs has implemented solutions that save up to 50% of work time by redesigning the IT systems. Don't accept crappy IT ergonomics. It's bad for your health. Instead, contact Kisco Labs. The link is in the show notes. You're listening to Bossable Podcast, and I'm your host, Sami. Before we get started, I need to thank someone. But the problem is that I don't know who to thank. Last week, the podcast received a huge sudden bump in listeners, which probably means that someone did something somewhere. But despite my investigative efforts, I still don't know who. But whoever it was, thank you. And to all the new listeners, welcome. The podcast audience is currently growing at a very strong pace, and that's a good motivator for me to continue doing this. So keep sharing the episodes if you like them, and review the podcast on iTunes to help it rank better on the top lists. Okay, but now, let's get to the good stuff. So last week, I flew to Malmö, Sweden, to do some interviews, because I knew a bunch of interesting people are going to be there for the Oradev conference. And this is the first of those interviews, and it's with Jim Benson, the creator of Personal Kanban and Lean Coffee. So we delve into Personal Kanban, which is an approach to dealing with the overload of stuff you need to deal with. We dig into its two simple rules, visualizing work and limiting work in progress. We then walk through Lean Coffee, which is a simple and effective way to run your meetings. And in the end, we discuss Jim's lessons on collaboration from his years in working to improve it in organizations. Enjoy the episode.
Well, my name is Jim Benson. I'm the author of several books, I guess, now, but the primary one is Personal Kanban. I released that in 2010, won a Shingo in 2011 for it. My background is originally in psychology, so I went to school in psychology and got close to graduating and realized...
close.
I looked around and said, wow, if I graduate with these people, I'll be around these people the rest of my life. And a lot of people go into psychology to figure out what's wrong with them. And so I switched instead to urban planning and to transportation engineering. And built freeways and subways and light rail systems for about 12 or 15 years after that. Billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar projects with teams of hundreds of people who had never met each other before there was an internet. So,
wow.
Yeah. So people today are like, hey, I got a team of 10 people and they're spread out. I'm like, yeah, I feel so bad for you guys. I did that for a long time. I got frustrated at one point and decided I was going to do something simpler. And that was to start a software company that made software specifically for government to make government better stewards of their data and more collaborative. So they would offer RFPs and we would answer those RFPs with proposals that were specifically designed to meet their requirements, but then also to do those two things. Because obviously that was something I'd been frustrated with my clients.
Okay, yeah.
And we started off as an XP shop. This was in 99. We got governments around the world to write us tender in Agile speak. So people today say Agile contracting is hard.
It was really hard back then.
Yeah. Well, but that's just it. It was never hard.
Yeah.
It just simply is never hard. It's that most software people don't know how to sell stuff. And if you go to anybody and you say, hey, you know, you have these milestones, but that seems like a long time to wait for you to get feedback. Let's do that faster. they're generally not going to say no. So, so we did that and it worked quite well. We were really happy with that. And we did that for 7 years or so. And then realized at one point that our software developers knew what they were doing, but didn't know how much stuff they were doing. And at that time, my friend David Anderson and I were having weekly meetings at Milady's Pub in Seattle. And we were trying to figure out how to implement his first book, which was Agile Management, which is a very difficult to implement book. And we started to build the first Kanbans on some napkins in Milady's Pub. And David took his to become, you know, the Kanban methodologies that he's brought out. But my background's in psychology and the individual. And so I took mine to my company and we made more of the personal Kanban method, if you will. And that so immediately became so popular, like overwhelmingly, that I closed the company. and have been doing this ever since, been just traveling the world and helping people solve problems, helping people understand their work, and getting teams and individuals under control, I guess you might say.
Well, that's amazing. So actually, so you've been working with David since the very beginning of the Kanban day. So what do you feel like, what are the differences between the two approaches, if you call them approaches, whatever you want to call them?
Well, so David has two products, more or less. He's got his ESP product and the Kanban method. And David's method is very tailored to software development in particular, and to software development in fairly complex organizations. And there's a lot of good things in David's books about measuring cost of delay and measuring the flow of work and being able to control those things. The focus of personal Kanban, while it sounds like it's just on the individual, the word personal actually means of value to people, as opposed to industrial Kanban, which is of interest to manufacturing.
Yeah. To the organization.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so we try and stress a few things. One is that you can have all the great processes in the world, but if individuals are still overloaded, your system is going to break down. The second is that almost every individual we've ever met is overloaded. So us understanding our individual work and understanding how we relate to other people is ridiculously important. And we've worked in over 40 countries now and have yet to find a place where that has not been true.
Yeah. So there's two rules to personal Kanban. What are those rules?
To visualize your work and to limit your work in process.
Why is it that, like, two rules sounds like very few rules?
Yeah. So this is why personal Kanban is now used in almost every vertical globally, right? The simplest systems are the most flexible, and they're the most universal. So yes, there are things that extend beyond those two rules. You should be continuously improving. You should always be asking yourself if you're building the right thing. You should ask yourself, you know, who the customer is and what problem you're trying to solve. But initially, we just want people to just slow down and focus. And then after that, those other things tend to come fairly naturally.
So actually, let's delve a little deeper into the rules. So so if when you say visualize your work, what does that mean?
Okay. So the typical Kanban board, whether it's one of, you know, a Kanban method board or one of ours, is typically a set of columns that go from left to right, and they start from something not being done yet to flowing through the steps it takes to be done and ending it at done. There's a discovery phase where you figure out what those steps are. But you are visualizing your work so that you can see not just what you're doing. So it's not just a task list, but the context of what's coming up, the methods and the flow of the work as you're doing it, and then what's completed. And we have seen people visualize their work with Legos. We've seen people visualize their work.
Was that Hawken?
No, it wasn't Hawken. Although he does visualize himself as a Lego. Yes. So he's a little unique that way. But we've also seen people visualize their, so the we worked with the Food and Agriculture Office of the UN in Rome. And we set up a board with them that flowed from left to right. And they used that for a little while. And then one day we got in a call with them and they said, oh, you're going to hate what we've done. I was like, I don't hate a lot of things. So why don't you give it a shot? And they showed us what they built. And their board was like a target. So it was a big circle on the outside with concentric circles going in. And as work flowed, it flowed in. And so the outside was a lot of options that hadn't been vetted yet. The center ring was options that were in the process of being vetted. And the third one were options that were actually going to move forward into projects for the FAO.
Yeah.
And as they moved in, the size of the circles were the whip limit, because you could only fit so many post-it notes in the circles.
That's genius.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. And so they're like, you're going to hate this because it doesn't flow from left to right. I'm like, I just want you to see it. I don't care how it flows. I thought it was gorgeous. It was creative, and it met what they needed to do. So I don't particularly care how people visualize their work. We've found that method of having the post-it notes and pulling them from left to right is not only a kind of a universal pattern that most work can fit into, but it also involves some kinesthetic feedback when you're moving the ticket that reinforces the work that you're doing, your desire to finish things, and how you relate to each individual task, the ownership you take of it.
So how do you think that, like, what's the difference between a Kanban or personal Kanban boards backlog and a to-do list? Like, isn't it the same thing?
Well, it's definitely things you need to, or you could do.
Sure.
But the first thing is that when you have a to-do list, it's got stuff in it, and then you finish that stuff, you take your pen and you angrily cross it out. So you kill your work.
Yeah.
That makes it pretty hard to go back and assess what you have done. You'll usually wad it up at the end of the day and start with a new one the next day, which is in fact what books tell you to do. They say, throw away your old one. Well, it's hard to continuously improve if you don't know what you've done. And so what we tend to do is, once we finish a thing, unless it was weird, so if it's just a thing we do every day or just a normal thing, or it goes the way we expect it to, we'll forget that we've done it. So anybody that's ever tried to fill out a timesheet will look back and go, what the hell did I do last Tuesday?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're like, digging through stuff and looking all over the place to figure out what they did. And it's because we actively will forget what we've done. So the board does a couple of things. One is it makes things tangible and sized. So they've gone from being a concept, which they still are as a line item, to a physical thing. And we can measure the flow of that physical thing through time and space. We can appreciate the importance of that thing because it now has mass.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's done, it doesn't leave our consciousness. We will look back at the end of the day and say, oh, hey, I actually did stuff.
Yeah.
I am not a waste of space.
Sure.
How awesome.
And actually, like, when building boards, I think a lot of people, like, when we have the done column, and people say that we don't need the done column, we could just throw out the post-its when we're done. And I always say that, like, don't do that. Like, it's really rewarding to be able to see the done column being full.
Well, and another thing that you can do is, in the done column, you can ask yourself things like, what do I want to know about my work? Like, you can make some sections in there and you could say, I loved it. It was okay. I hated it. And you can start to get some sentiment analysis on yourself. So you can say things like, maybe ending my day with work that I hate isn't a good idea.
Yeah.
Or maybe I always hate these things. Can I give them to somebody else? Is there someone else in the office that actually might like doing this unbelievably horrible thing?
Sure.
And there may be things like, You have three projects and you're supposed to be 20% on each of them. And you go through and you find out that you're only working in one project. And why is that? Well, it's because that's the loudest project manager. So you can bring that loud project manager over and say, look, your force of will is at odds with what the company has told me to do, you know, that type of thing. So there's a million different ways that you can measure that, but you can do all sorts of fun tricks with the done column.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So, and the second rule is limiting your work in progress. Mm-hmm. So what does that even mean?
Well, when we had our software company and we would ask our developers, what are you doing? They would say, I'm doing this. And what they wouldn't say is all the things that they'd started but not completed. So if you ask someone what they're working on, they will tell you the thing that they're kind of immediately engaged in, but they won't tell you all of the things that are distracting them. And so the very first board that we built was actually in a mind map. And we just said, okay, list all the things that you're working on this mind map. And then the mind map became unreadable because there was so much crap on it. And we're like, you know, you really need to limit stuff. And so then we went through a series of iterations about how do you limit your work? So we said, okay, just put stuff up that you're going to work on today. And then some of that stuff would go up and then it wouldn't come off for weeks. It's like, okay, that didn't work. Or I'm going to work on these 85 things today. So when we start things, we engage with them. So each one of those pieces of work is a relationship, right? So someone somewhere needs that work, and it's likely that they're going to come asking for it if it's not done in time. So every time we start one of those things, we're opening a conversation, and we're opening our ability to be interrupted. And that means that the more we're interrupted, the slower it is to get our work done, which means that not only are more tasks distracting us, but they're inviting us to other distractions. So when we limit our work in process, we basically specifically say, I'm only going to be doing three things at a time so that I can focus on them and finish, and so that I don't open myself up to being, you know, serially, repeatedly, constantly interrupted.
And how do you, pragmatically, how do you do limiting WIP?
So I've had a lot of people say, you know, I had my Kanban up, I was limiting WIP, life was really good, and then I had this emergency and I blew my WIP limit and I fell off the wagon, and now I feel like I can't do personal Kanban anymore. Yeah. It's like, yes, that's right, because we have our own police force. And we know that you have sinned. Yeah. So you know, we've got, you know, both religious and legal grounds to completely destroy you. So you absolutely better not start up a Kanban again. So human beings do their work, they get overloaded, they do their work and they get overloaded. And I'm no exception. But in general, I practiced at it enough that Two things are true. One is it makes me very uncomfortable to have more than three tickets in doing, and usually I only have one or two. I'm pretty good now at seeing what I can actually finish next and pulling that in, as opposed to pulling in the next most important thing that maybe I can't finish because I have to wait for somebody to help me or something, and they're not around. And people do that all the time. They start the next quote unquote important thing, the thing that's been prioritized, but they don't actually have the ability to finish it. So I will always be pulling the thing where it's like, I know I can finish this. I know I can finish this. I know I can finish this. And then if it ends up that there's like big kind of cranky tickets that I haven't been able to get to, then I'll just take a look at those and say, okay, well, that has to be done. How am I going to get that done? Is that actually a ticket or is it five tickets and I'm, you know, deluding myself? Or do I just need to tell somebody, you know what, I'm going to lock myself in a closet today and finish this one thing. And, you know, for us, that ends up being things like, like text for websites. That's like the worst. It's always like every word has to count. It's super painstaking. Oddly enough, writing blog posts, I can write an entire blog post in 10 minutes. I just sit down and it's all gone. So, you know, we all have our different strengths and, those are kind of mine, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And at the moment, like you've been doing personal Kanban for quite a while. And do you still like, is your main method still like post-its, like on a physical board?
So since modus operandi is traveling all the time and we're not necessarily traveling to the same place, we have two boards that are online. The first board is tasks, just tasks of things that John and Tony Ann and I are doing. The other board is our production board, and that's largely geared towards Modus Institute. So what classes are in process and the phases in that. So that is more of a value-based board. Anywhere I go, and this is either attractive or pathetic.
I'm looking forward to this.
You can see, you know, like in my hotel room or whatever, that there is this impromptu little Kanban where I've written down like the five things that I need to do, and I'm moving them across some sort of imaginary or real board. So it ends up being both analog and digital. We will analog whenever we can. Mm-hmm. But we always need the digital to communicate with the others.
Sure, sure. What do you feel that, like, if you were to summarize the benefits that you've gotten in your life from personal Kanban, what would you say those benefits are?
I don't leave things half done anymore. So I've always been a writer and I've always been a musician. And I find sometimes that I will be digging through an old hard drive or worse yet, a bunch of cassette tapes or something. And I'll find all of these things that I did that were awesome that I didn't finish because I got distracted and went on to something else.
Yeah.
And now that ticket would stay there and it would remind me, no, I exist and you can kill me, but you have to. You have to be conscious of this task aside that you're about to undertake. The other thing is I am much better at not promising people things I can't deliver. And it wasn't that I was flighty or flaky or anything. It was because I, like everybody else, had too much stuff to do. And I made a promise and I just couldn't deliver because of the bulk of the work I had to do.
That reminds me of one of the things that I kind of like about personal Kanban is that, like, compared to I've read a lot of personal development books and they always have this ideal person that's super efficient and super effective and so on, and I think that, like, personal Kanban has more of a human feel to it, that, like, all around it, it's like you're human, you're gonna fuck it up, and yes. It's okay.
Yeah. No, that's 100% it. Yeah. Is in some of my talks, I say human beings only do two things. We fuck things up and we die. Those are the only two things that we do right. Okay. Reliably. And that's why success feels good, because it's actually not normal. It's we put ourselves under such strain to be perfect or even just better than mediocre. And part of the thing is that, like, our bar for mediocrity is incredibly low. It's not like all of human potential and you're at the median of all of human potential. It's like people have held themselves way below our potential for so long that mediocre is almost nothing.
Yeah.
And then we feel bad when we get put in that situation where we've done work and we know we could have done better, but we had a crappy deadline. We're working on five projects. Our parents are sick. We've got our water heater broke in our house and all of these other things. And we just don't have the mental bandwidth or the emotional bandwidth to deal with all that crap. Both for Tony Ann and myself, 2016 was kind of a shit show. All sorts of really bad things happened during the year, and we had to deal with those things. And I can't imagine what we would have done if we would have been in a usual overloaded situation, because it was hard enough as it was, you know? And that's, you know, when you talk about the human part, that's for us, that's the whole human part, is, you know, make sure that people smile from time to time.
Yeah. I also like how you talk about WIP, or the like WIP limits being context specific, mm-hmm. that depending on the situation, you might need a lower WIP limit, or if everything is good, then you might have a higher WIP limit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, not to get too much of a bummer or too personal, but, we're in Malmo now, and, it's important. The city is important to me because I came here several times with my friend Jean Tabeka, who passed away in June. And yesterday was her birthday, and we're always here on her birthday, and we always went to this one restaurant downtown. And so last night, I went over by myself and had her birthday by myself, or with her in the, you know, grander scheme of things.
Sure.
And when I got there, I took the phone out, you know, picture Jean on the phone, took the phone out, but I put the phone into airplane mode. Mm-hmm. Because I definitely wanted to limit my WIP for that. I didn't want text messages or phone calls or emails or Facebook or Twitter or anything else to interrupt that. That was a total period of focus. And we don't allow ourselves that luxury often enough. We don't pull ourselves off the grid anymore.
And it's become increasingly difficult. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I love mornings, because no one is awake and no one will send you any messages. And because it's, I think, like doing that, like putting your phone in airplane mode, it's ridiculously hard.
Yeah.
Like making that decision that I'm actually going to disconnect completely. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to just silence it. I'm actually going to like turn it into airplane mode.
Yeah.
And doing that is super hard. And I sometimes find it just easier to just wake up so early that no one will email me or do anything.
Right. Well, I mean, and you rarely find yourself in a situation like I was in last night where it's just utterly justifiable.
Sure.
And so if you can't justify it, then in your head, you're always thinking, what if someone gets hurt? You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, what if a mountain erupts, or we're attacked by zombies or something? While and I've shut my phone off, then I'm just going to be the jerk.
And it's crazy how strong that feeling is. I just, like, a couple of days ago, my phone stopped working for some reason. It wouldn't turn on. Mm-hmm. And like that never happens. I mean, I don't remember like another situation similar to that. Mm-hmm. And it was probably out for like an hour or something when I'm like, after which I managed to like charge it a little and then it went on. Mm-hmm. But during that hour, I was stressed out about like maybe my wife needs to call me and I won't be able to pick up. And I was completely stressed out about that. I was like, just an hour. I mean, it's crazy.
Yes. 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 It's about the time that you usually spend taking a shower. I think you're okay.
Yeah. And I think there's the difference when the phone is turned off, that you're not like it when someone tries to call it and it like it says that it's not like on the network at all. Uh-huh. And that's the crazy part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so that's in the book and on the website, we talk about using the Pomodoro technique to disengage. And there's two simultaneous social contracts or social permissions that are happening there. The first is you're giving yourself permission to go off the grid for 25 minutes, but you're also telling everybody else, I will be back to talk to you in 25 minutes or less. So don't freak out while I'm gone, because I'm not gone that long. I just need to just process whatever this thing is that I'm working on. And I think that's for me is the most beautiful thing about that technique, is it does seem to be just at that limit where no one will interrupt you, unless, you know, the building really is on fire, or they really do need a defibrillator or something, you know, then that's fine.
Sure. Of course.
Yeah. So I love that technique, and I love how it can help you move a lot of tickets, but still not get you ostracized or beaten.
I think one of the best things that you can do for your sleep is to, like, of course, have your phone on silent, but also turn it, like, the other way around, that the screen is set towards the table so that when something pops up, you won't see it. Mm-hmm. Because at least I had the problem, like, if I woke up and I saw the light blinking on mm-hmm. my phone, I couldn't sleep if I didn't, like, just take a quick look mm-hmm. at what's going on. Mm-hmm. And when I did that, I couldn't yep. sleep anymore.
And you just know that if that was true, you'd pick it up and it would say, you know, Sammy, I'm trapped in a well. You have to come get me right now. Whatever it is was surely going to be urgent.
And it always was. Every time I looked, it was super urgent. Yeah. Okay. Another thing that you are the creator of, is it right to mm-hmm. say that, is Lean Coffee?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into that a little. So what is Lean Coffee?
So Lean Coffee is a democratic way to hold a meeting, which sounds all technical, and maybe it is, but quite simply what we do is we will lay out a quick kind of options doing and done on the table, and usually a learnings or epiphanies or whatever at the end. And we tell everybody around the table, write down anything that you want to talk about on a post-it note that goes into the options column or the backlog. And then you vote on what you want to talk about. And then you talk about those things in order. And as you're talking about them, if people learn something, and often we have to teach people what learning feels like, but you write down what you learned and you put it in the final column, because meetings need to have a product in order for people to feel like they were useful, or frankly, for them to be useful at all. And people leave meetings and they say, you know, that meeting's awful, I hate meetings, blah, 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 blah. But they neither understand what they learned or what other people learned. And if you do go through a whole meeting and nobody puts anything over there, then you can have a conversation about it. But what's more likely is that you were in a meeting where other people learned things and the meeting was actually valuable. But the goal here for this is, when we call meetings, people tend to bring strong agendas, and they're told, in fact, in books and other things, always have a strong agenda, send it out first, tell everybody what they have to do and blah, 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 blah. But what happens when I get your agenda is I look at it and I go through something that psychologists call reactance, which is I look at it and I'm like, do I agree with this? Am I bound by it? And what do I want instead? And then I come to the meeting with my agenda and I'm going to subvert your agenda. And then nobody likes the meeting because it's a power struggle. So this way you have like a topic, say that, you know, the meeting is going to be, you know, how to solve all of the world's ills. You're like, great. And everybody shows up. Theoretically, you've invited people who are smart and you get the best thinking and the best prioritization of the people that arrive.
So it's basically a very, very like simple way of running a meeting and visualizing work during that meeting.
Yes, yes. And diffusing a lot of the social and political problems that meetings tend to generally have. So if I come with my agenda and I'm coming to a Lean Coffee meeting, I'll write it down on a post-it, and if I put it down and no one votes for it, I know pretty clearly that no one else wanted to talk about the thing that was so important to me. And that's wickedly important, because people will derail meetings for things that, you know, everybody else is rolling their eyes saying, oh my God, I can't believe we're talking about this again. So we started this in Seattle for one reason and one reason only. My friend Jeremy Lightsmith said, hey, all these people are doing personal Kanban and stuff in Seattle. We should have a lean working group. You know, a professional organization. And I was like, I don't want to invite speakers. I don't want to find space. I don't want to buy pizza. I do not want to do any of the things that involve. But I do want to talk about this stuff. Yeah. So we started the first Lean Coffee at a coffee shop in Seattle. Now there's over 130 of them globally, which still just seems like... freakishly weird to me. But it's really caught on. It's so funny. So the other night, I went to downtown Malmo with a guy that I met when I was coming in on the train. And we're sitting down and we're talking, and it's like, yeah, well, you know, Kanban, blah, 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 blah. And then we're eating, and he's like, you know, well, what I really love is lean coffee. I was like, oh, yeah, well, you know, when we created that, he's like, you created a lean coffee? So I couldn't care less about the whole Kanban thing. But he's like, oh, my God, you made lean coffee. That's so cool. Yeah.
But it's a great concept because it is so super easy to understand and start using, and it is very easy to get benefits out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like walking into a meeting. You don't even need to explain people that we're going to be doing lean coffee. You can just start like, ask them to write the stuff that they want to talk about on post-its, and you can like ninja lean coffee. You don't need to tell them about it.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and so that's the thing, is that the best system, and you can see this in all of the things that Tony Ann and I have created. We go out of our way to make sure that the system is as simple as possible. And the reason is that if you have a bunch of rules, then people sit there and try and figure out what the rules are. And then the system itself becomes an impediment to playing the rules. So the game Dungeons and Dragons, when I was a kid, it had a book, and then it had two books, and then it had five books, and then it had a million books, and then it was nearly impossible to play. It's like, I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago. They basically set fire to all of their own books and they started over again. They're like, if we don't simplify this, no one's playing this anymore, because there's like thousands of pages of potential rules. And so simple systems like that are just so much fun to use, because they don't threaten people. You know, it's like, oh my God, I have to do all that stuff? No, you don't have to do all that stuff. Just write stuff on a post-it note and then flap your mouth.
By the way, I've used lean coffee style meetings with a timer on the topics.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, so that is incredibly helpful for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's never anybody's job to stop talking.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so we will just keep going. And if there's that person in the room that always says, well, maybe we're done, that person's going to be right a certain percentage of the time. They're going to be wrong a certain percentage of the time. And then they're going to be known as a person that just interrupts people and is rude. So we wanted the system to be able to allow people to vote, but not feel like it was a judgment call. So I don't really like time boxing conceptually, but I've not been able to come up with any other non-contrived way. So just those periodic checks to make sure, like, is this meeting going forward or is this meeting going downhill?
Yeah. And I also found that the best way to do it is that you actually have like a timer, that not someone who looks at the clock, and when 10 minutes is done, they say that 10 minutes is done.
Yeah.
Because like, then it's basically the same thing. It's the person interrupting.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's something like mechanical, if it's a phone or something,
yeah,
it's the phone doing the interruption,
totally.
not the person.
Totally. And it's one of the no matter what we do with our mouth, politics comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Even if it's just, hey, 10 minutes, that's still a political statement. But the phone has no agenda.
Yeah, it's neutral.
Yeah. Yeah.
You spend many years of your career working on basically on collaboration. Would that be the right way to put it?
That would be a very right way to put it. So whether it was in trying to build cities that were livable,
yep,
so walkable neighborhoods, safe cities, transportation that goes where and when people want to get there, all very much building the larger hive of a collaborative city. While I was doing that, I was also working with some guys in the Bay Area and elsewhere, most notably a guy named Howard Rheingold, a guy named Jerry Mikulski and a guy named Sam Rose in Michigan. And we were working on something that's called the Collaboration Commons, which was a joint venture with the Institute for the Future at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And we were gathering all of the research from collaboration, regardless of where it came from, whether it was biomimicry or from, you know, cell division or what have you.
Yeah.
And we were examining from as much of a cross-disciplinary way as we could, what does it mean for individual things to work with other individual things to create more than the sum of those individual things? Wonderful, fascinating, fun work with good people. So yes, I've been ridiculously focused on this for a while.
And this is probably the broadest question that I can ask about this, but what are your like most important lessons on collaboration from all these years?
The most practical thing I think is, people get frustrated when they're at work. And they say, I hate meetings and I have to come in at 2 o'clock in the morning to get my work done or stay until 8 because then people won't interrupt me. And fundamentally, we start to lose sight of the fact that the only reason we go to companies is to work in the company of others. And the only way that we create value is with other people. So if we go, you know, put ourselves on an island somewhere, we're not going to be creating a lot of value because we have no customer. So that's a big one for me. The other is the human beings are generally good and generally collaborative. They can be frustrating and they can be messy, but we have an innate tendency to want to help when we can see what the results of that help will be. You know, we're obviously very good at blowing each other up. You know, we're very good at attacking each other. You know, we're good at doing a lot of negative things, but we allow those outliers to scare us into thinking that that's what human nature is and not what that's a pathology that is working counter to human nature, which is actually more collaborative.
That's really good. I wanted to have a silence because that might be a really good ending quote. That was really nice.
So there you go. That's the first interview from Malmö. The second one will be out in 2 weeks. While waiting, I recommend you try this stuff out. Run your next meeting lean coffee style. Organize your work with a personal Kanban board. But then again, don't worry about it too much. It's also okay not to add anything to your to-do list after listening to an episode of Bossable. So yeah, don't worry about it too much. Most importantly, have a great week.